Today, dollar takes no prisoners as Fed's hawkish cut spooked markets. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, World Latest Post, covering finance and property news. Well, there was always going to be a question about the Fed's December decision. Would they react to the latest data or position ahead of the Trump 2.0 policy set coming in 2025? Well, it looks like both were in the minds of the Monetary Policy Committee as Federal Reserve officials lowered their benchmark interest rate for a third consecutive time, but reined in the number of cuts they expect in 2025, signalling greater caution over how quickly they can continue reducing borrowing costs.
The economy is strong overall and has made significant progress toward our goals over the past 2 years. The labor market has cooled from its formerly overheated state and remains solid. Inflation has moved much closer to our 2% longer run goal. We're committed to maintaining our economy's strength by supporting maximum employment and returning inflation to our 2% goal. To that end, today, the Federal Open Market Committee decided to take another step in reducing the degree of policy restraint by lowering our policy interest rate by a quarter percentage point.
The Federal Open Market Committee voted 11-1 on Wednesday in the U.S. to cut the federal funds rate to a range of 4.25 to 4.5%. Cleveland Fed President Beth Hammack voted against the action, preferring to hold rates steady. Markets fell heavily in the US and in Asia, with the Dow and the S&P 500 down more than 2.5% and the NASDAQ more than 3.5%. This was actually the largest post-Fed market move south in 4 years. Falls were widespread. The ASX 200 slid 1.7%. Bonds were stronger, with the two-year US note, which is more sensitive than longer maturities to Fed policy shifts, leading the move in treasuries, going up as much as 8 basis points to 4.33%. And the US dollar rose, with the DXY up to 108.10. Trying to read the Fed's thinking is not easy. With today's action, we have lowered our policy rate by a full percentage point from its peak, and our policy stance is now significantly less restrictive, Fed Chair Jerome Powell told reporters in the press conference following the Fed decision.
Today was a closer call, but we decided it was the right call because we thought it was the best decision to foster achievement of both of our goals, maximum employment and price stability. We see the risks as two-sided, moving too slowly and needlessly undermine economic activity in the labor market, or move too quickly and needlessly undermine our progress on inflation. So we're trying to steer between those two risks. And on balance, we decided to go ahead with a further cut, and I'll give you some details on why. Downside risks to the labor market do appear to have diminished, but the labor market is now looser than pre-pandemic, and it's clearly still cooling further. So far, in a gradual and orderly way. We don't think we need further cooling in the labor market to get inflation down to 2%. Job creation is now well below the level, or certainly below the level, that would hold unemployment constant. The job finding rate is low and declining, and other measures such as surveys of workers and businesses, quits, things like that, broadly show a much cooler labor market than there was, than we had in 2019. It's still quite gradually cooling. So we keep an eye on that. Inflation, we see that story as still broadly on track, and I'll tell you why. We've made a great deal of progress. 12-month core inflation, as I mentioned, through November is estimated at 2.8%, down from a high of 5.6%. But 12-month inflation has actually been moving sideways as we are lapping the very low readings of late last year. Housing services inflation actually is steadily coming down now, albeit at a slower pace than we might like, but it has now come down substantially and it is making progress slower than hoped. And we've had recent high readings from non-market services and some bumpiness for goods. So I'll just say, so remember that we coupled this decision today with the extent and timing language in the post-meeting statement that signals that we are at or near a point at which it will be appropriate to slow the pace of further adjustments. You ask about 2025. I think that the slower pace of cuts for next year really reflects both the higher inflation readings we've had this year and the expectation that inflation will be higher. You saw in the SEP that risks and uncertainty around inflation we see as higher. Nonetheless, we see ourselves as still on track to continue to cut. I think the actual cuts that we make next year will not be because of anything we wrote down today. We're going to react to data. That's just the general sense of what the committee thinks is likely to be appropriate.
We can therefore be more cautious as we consider further adjustments to our policy rates. Nonetheless, Powell added that interest rates were still meaningfully restricting economic activity, and the Fed is on track to continue to cut, but he said officials would have to see more progress on inflation before making additional rate cuts. New quarterly forecasts showed that several officials penciled in fewer rate cuts for next year than they'd estimated just a few months ago, and they saw inflation making considerably less progress in 2025. They now see their benchmark rate reaching a range of 3.75% to 4% by the end of 2025. That implies just 2 quarter percentage point cuts, according to the median estimate, down from 4. Only 5 officials indicated a preference for more reductions next year. Majority of economists had been expecting, let's say, 3 cuts next year, so this is below market expectations. Powell also fielded a question about how the central bank may respond to potential tariffs from the Trump administration.
Thank you, Chris Rugaber at Associated Press. Thanks for taking the question. In September 2018, the Fed staff in the Teal Book discussed a policy of looking through any new tariffs as long as there were one-time increases and inflation expectations remained anchored. Could you comment on if that analysis remains effective and any other thinking on tariffs generally that you can share?
So I do think that the September 2018 Teal Book alternative simulations are a good place to start. I happen to have brought them here with me today. I'm sure you have them too. They're a good starting point, and I would just say, it's 6 years old analysis, but nonetheless, this is still, I think, the right questions to ask. And you know, there were two simulations. One was seeing through. One was not. And I'd point you to, there's some language in the see-through paragraph that says, you know, that considers situations in which it might be appropriate to see through inflation, and then names some conditions that in which it might not be. In any case, this is not a question that's in front of us right now. We won't face that question. We don't know when we'll face that question. What the committee's doing now is discussing pathways and understanding, again, the ways in which tariff-driven inflation can affect tariffs can affect inflation in the economy and how to think about that. So we've done a good bit of work, all of us have, each of us has, and you know, it puts us in position when we finally do see what the actual policies are to make a more careful, thoughtful assessment of what might be the appropriate policy response.
Great. And just a quick follow. Do you, given the recent bout of inflation that we've been through, with consumers seeing how prices can rise and businesses seeing that they can raise prices at least for some time, does that make it a little bit riskier to look through tariffs? I mean, do you feel you have to respond more quickly to inflation threats, given what we've seen in the past few years?
So the main thing is, and this is also a point in these alternative simulations, is there are just many factors that go into how much tariffs will even go into consumer inflation, how persistent will that be, and so we just don't know really very much at all about the actual policies, so it's very premature to try to make any kind of conclusion. We don't know what will be tariffed from what countries, for how long, in what size. We don't know whether there'll be retaliatory tariffs. We don't know what the transmission of any of that will be into consumer prices. To your point as well, I wouldn't say that we know whether the last episode is or is not a good model for what happened. You pointed out we've just been through a period of high inflation. We've just gotten through that period. That's a difference. There was also quite a bit of diversion of trade away from China to other countries since that may have effects. I don't know. I just think we need to take our time, not rush, and make a very careful assessment, but only when we've actually seen what the policies are and how they're implemented And, you know, we're just not at that stage. We're at the stage of doing what other forecasters are doing, which is kind of thinking about these questions, but not trying to get to definitive answers for some time.
Policymakers have now lowered their benchmark lending rate by a full percentage point since mid-September, when they began cutting with an aggressive half-point move. But interestingly, long-term rates and mortgages are higher because of the move in the bond markets. So the impact on the real economy is still quite significant. At the time, they were encouraged by falling inflation, and they worried that the labour market was approaching a dangerous tipping point. But since then, the landscape has shifted. The labour market has proved resilient, with payrolls growing by an average 183,000 over the past 3 months. The unemployment rate ticked up to 4.2% in November, but remains low by historical standards. Pallad said earlier in the month that downside risks to the labour market appear to have receded, although he did concede that the jobs market was slowing just a little. Policymakers now see the unemployment rate 4.3% in 2025, and they also slightly raised their forecast for economic growth in 2025 to 2.1%. Meanwhile, recent price data has raised concerns that inflation may be stalling above the Fed's 2% target, prompting a number of Fed officials to say that they prefer to slow the pace of cuts. Some have done so while voicing confidence that inflation will continue to decline, pointing to factors such an anticipated slowdown in housing costs. Others, like Fed Governor Michelle Bowman, have emphasized that inflation remains uncomfortably above the Fed's goal. The median projection for inflation at the end of next year has jumped to 2.5% from 2.1% in September. Officials again raised their median estimate of where the policy rate will settle over the long run to 3% from 2.9%. And so the neutral rate may be a little higher, although Powell did concede that trying to identify where the neutral rate was complicated and difficult and moved about.
For the questions, Edward Lawrence from Fox Business. So you say that we're closer to the neutral rate. What percent do you see and the committee believes, where is that neutral rate?
So I'll say a couple of things. First of all, when we write down in the summary of economic projections is the longer run neutral rate, which is the neutral rate at a time when supply and demand are in balance, the full economy is in balance, and no shocks are hitting the economy. That is not where we are right now. So when we're making monetary policy at the Fed, that's not the question we're asking. So you can't do a straight read between those longer run numbers that we write down and what we think the appropriate policy should be. So basically, at any given time, various shocks are hitting the economy. And so what we're doing in real time is we're looking at our policy stance and we're looking at the way it's hitting the economy. And particularly, we look at the effects it's having as we try to move the economy toward maximum employment and price stability. And the answer can be, there are things that affect the economy that are lasting but not permanent. And the ones that are permanent are the ones that would be in our star. The ones that could be lasting but nonetheless go away over time, they could actually affect what's sort of technically the appropriate neutral stance in near term. So we're looking at that, and we don't know exactly where it is, but as I like to say, we know it by its works. And I think what we know for sure is that we're 100 basis points closer to it right now. There are many estimates of where that might be, and we know we're a lot closer to it. And I think we're in a good place, but I think from here, it's a new phase, and we're going to be, cautious about further cuts.
But I think that the markets are looking for a little more clarity. I mean, I've heard estimates from 2.9% to 4%. I think the markets would like to see a little more clarity about a year out, 18 months out, as to where that goalpost, for lack of a better term, is, because at the moment it looks big.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, there are countless models of what a neutral rate might be at any given time. There are empirical models, there are theoretical models, there are things that combine them, and they have as many different answers as you'd like. So there is no real certainty. And I mean, it's actually a good thing to know that we don't know exactly where it is. So you're not tempted to think, oh, I think this model or this estimate is right. You just have to be open to the empirical data that are coming in, and also how it's affecting the outlook. And it's not made any easier by the fact that that our policy works with long and variable lags. Nonetheless, that is the job we have, and so we're. I think we need. It's appropriate for us now to proceed cautiously. Now that we're 100 basis points closer to neutral, and will do so. Meanwhile, the economy seems to be in good shape, and these cuts will certainly help to support economic activity and the labor market while we can still make progress on inflation because policy is still meaningfully restrictive.
Some have suggested that the neutral rate has moved higher, meaning officials can reach it with fewer cuts than previously anticipated.
So this does seem similar to the dynamic in 2016 during the last transition to a Trump administration, where the committee saw slightly tighter policy, in part in expected anticipation of the fiscal policy stance that was seen evolving over the year. Some of it was a data mark-to-market exercise, and some of it was anticipation of fiscal. What's the split on this one? How much of this was accounting for inflation data that was coming in, and how much of it is expecting that there will be inflationary fiscal policy next year?
I'd say I'd point to five or six things, and I'd start. Let me start by saying that we think the economy is in a really good place, and we think policy is in a really good place. Let's remember that the economy is growing 2.5% this year. That inflation has come down by 50% from 5.6% to 2.6%. Headline inflation is 2.5% on a 12-month basis. We're actually in a really good starting place here. But since so what's really driving the slower rate cut path? First thing is growth is stronger, right? The economy grew faster in the second half of 2024 so far than we had expected, and is expected to be above what our expectations in September next year as well. Unemployment is lower, and in the SEP you'll see that participants think that the downside risks are less and uncertainty is less. So that's more strength, right? Inflation is higher, as we talked about. Inflation's higher this year. It's also higher in the forecast next year. I'd also point out that we're closer to the neutral rate, which is another reason to be cautious about further moves. But then getting to your point, there's also there's uncertainty. Uncertainty around inflation, I pointed out, is actually higher. It's also in the case of some people, the way I would say it is this. Some people did take a very preliminary step and start to incorporate highly conditional estimates of economic effects of policies into their forecasts at this meeting and said so in the meeting. Some people said they didn't do so, and some people didn't say whether they did or not. So we have people making a bunch of different approaches to that. But some did identify policy uncertainty as one of the reasons for they're writing down more uncertainty around inflation. The point about uncertainty is it's kind of common sense thinking that when the path is uncertain, you go a little bit slower. It's not unlike driving on a foggy night or walking into a dark room full of furniture. You just slow down, and so that may have affected some of the people. But as I said, there's a range of approaches on the committee.
If I could follow up on that, you mentioned the risk and uncertainty indexes toward the back of the document. The upside risk to inflation jumped quite substantially. The only thing really that's happened, you mentioned that the disinflationary story remains intact, yet the risk weighting has jumped to the upside. The only real thing that's happened is November 5th in the meantime. Is it fair to say that that's what's driving the higher sense of upside risk on inflation?
Actually, that's not the only thing that's happened. What's happened is that our forecasts for inflation for this year, I think, are 5/10 higher than they were in September. So you had 2 months of higher inflation, September and October. As I mentioned, November is back on track, but once again we've had a year-end projection for inflation, and it's kind of fallen apart as we've approached the end of the year. So that is certainly a large factor in people's thinking. I can tell you that might be the single biggest factor is inflation has once again underperformed relative to expectations. It's still going to be between 2.5 and 3. It's way below where it was, but we really want to see progress on inflation to as I mentioned, as we think about further cuts, we're going to be looking for progress on inflation. We have been moving sideways on 12-month inflation as the 12-month window moves. That's in part because inflation was very, very low measured in the fourth quarter of 2023. Nonetheless, as we go forward, we're going to want to be seeing further progress on bringing inflation down and keeping a solid labor market.
Trump's proposed policies on trade, immigration, and taxation do add another element of uncertainty to the inflation outlook. Depending on how they're structured, those could put upward pressure on inflation and constrain the labor market, according to some. Powell has said that the Fed is modeling and evaluating Trump's proposals, but not yet incorporating them into decisions because it's unclear what specific form the policies will take. Now, the fallout has been quite significant. Central banks across Asia now face a difficult decision after the Federal Reserve's hawkish cut. And the question is, do they stage a costly fight back against the dollar strength or stand by and watch their currencies falter? The Federal Reserve signal that inflation concerns are back on the agenda led to a sharp sell-off in currencies across Asia on Thursday, for example, pushing the Indian rupee to a new all-time low against the greenback, and the Korean won to its weakest level since the financial crisis, and the Aussie dollar remains in very weak territory. The moves have reignited questions about how far central banks across Asia will be willing to go to defend their currencies and how much impact their moves will have. Indonesia's central bank said on Thursday that it was intervening to push back against a sell-off in the rupiah, while the People's Bank of China used its daily reference rate to support the yuan. It's hard to fight the hard dollar move against Asian currencies when it is primarily dollar-driven, which means regional central banks will have to play defense and try to smooth out depreciation pressures by trying to keep an orderly foreign exchange market, said Wee Kun Chong, a strategist at BNY Mellon in Hong Kong. And we've seen Asian currencies slide around 4% this year as the election of Donald Trump and the shifting expectations of Fed policy have encouraged a shift in dollar assets. Central banks in Asia have taken different approaches to containing dollar bulls over the past few months, while Bank of Indonesia has been vocal about its interventions. The Reserve Bank of India has preferred to operate quietly, using a mixture of offshore and onshore trades to bolster the rupee without public confirmation. Other central banks have used public statements to try to influence sentiment. For example, the People's Bank of China ramped up a support for the yuan on Thursday by setting a daily reference rate that was significantly stronger than the average. And the so-called fixing, which limits moves in the onshore yuan by 2% to either side, is at its strongest level relative to the forecast since July. The PBOC will continue to restrain the upside pressure on the dollar yuan for now, but I think the exchange rate will break to new highs in 2025 on the outbreak of a second US-China trade war, said Alvin Titan, head of FX strategy at RBC Capital Markets. Chinese state banks sold the dollar in the onshore market at the open and hardly offered to buy the greenback, according to traders. The dollar rally has complicated a widespread shift to monetary easing in Asia, with central banks across the region cutting rates this year, apart from, of course, Australia. Weaker currencies tend to raise the price of imports to a country, fueling domestic inflation, and further rate cuts could also put more pressure on currencies as investors look elsewhere for returns, exacerbating the impact of dollar strength. Asian central banks may need to focus on defending their currencies rather than cutting rates to support their domestic economies, said Marcella Chow, global market strategist for JP Morgan Asset Management, adding that central banks were still likely to maintain their easing bias. The yen weakened past the key level of 155 versus the dollar after the Bank of Japan kept interest rates steady. Japanese stocks fell slightly, but ended the day off their lows. The currency slid as much as 0.7% against the greenback to 155.85, a level last seen in November, as the governor spoke in his post-decision press conference. The decline on Thursday followed a 0.9% decline in the yen on Wednesday after the Federal Reserve cut those interest rates while signaling caution over future rate reductions. The Japanese government bonds fluctuated during the day and were up by about 15 bips at 142.29. The relatively modest reaction in markets reflected the expectation that the Bank of Japan would stand pat. Still, the breach of 155 is significant. It's closely watched by strategists who see a slide in this mark as a potential trigger for verbal intervention from Japanese authorities and added pressure on the Bank of Japan to hike rates sooner rather than later. The Fed's hawkish tilt and the Bank of Japan's pause could bring fresh reasons for yen traders to carry on, said Karu Chanara, chief investment strategist at Saxo Markets. The decision was largely priced in by overnight index swaps prior to the meeting, and predicted by the majority of economists. Rate hike bets have receded in recent weeks, contributing to a six-day losing streak in the yen through Monday, its longest stretch of declines versus the dollar since June. The yen's fate is actually out of the hands of the Bank of Japan. For now, the currency faces more of 2024's weakness and whiplash, a multi-decade low of $160 and a one-year high until policymakers deliver a bolder signal that policy normalization will resume. And of note to traders, the Bank of Japan said that the currency is more likely to affect prices than before. And board member Naoaki Tamura voted against the Stanpak decision, proposing a rate hike to 0.5% at the meeting they just held. There's some hawkish vibes in the decision, particularly one dissenter in favour of a hike, and more signs of wage price spiral intensifying. But it remains unlikely that Yuda can clearly signal a January rate hike, given the uncertainties around the Fed and the Trump presidency. Currency strategists have pointed to the risk of further vulnerability for the yen ahead if the Bank of Japan decides to keep interest rates unchanged until March or later. And of course, in Australia, all of this makes it less likely that the Reserve Bank of Australia will cut rates anytime soon. The truth is that we may well miss out any chance to drop rates because inflation is going to hang around. We expect more government support in terms of cost of living relief, which is costing a lot more. And I said yesterday, of course, in Australia, governments are spending big. So the bottom line is, markets have been reacting to the increased complexity, thanks to Trump, to the fact that inflation is remaining stickier, and in fact, in some areas, like the UK, is looking like it will rise. The Bank of England will probably not move in their decision today. And in Australia, higher for longer is what's coming, despite and perhaps because of the weaker Aussie dollar. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.